One day our instructor said poor health is a result of poor policy, and that really resonated with me. So it just made sense to take the plunge to dive into running for public office so that we could have our perspectives at the table and be a voice for the communities who are often ignored.
Bonjour, Ani, and welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lem. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show at its core. It's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a bunch of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, healthcare advocates, educators, language warriors. I could go on, but I won't. And they all have this wonderful mixture of passions. So we talk with our guests about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And I can't wait to continue amplifying Native voices today. How's it going, Cole?
Oh, it's going great. It was one of those days, after work, grabbing the old smudge. There's a lot of things moving and shaking right now in my life. So it's good to, after a full day of work, just to stop and reflect and relax and just let the smudge envelop you. So I was doing that, and I'm grounded and ready to go. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm not smudged up yet. I'm a little, I got a little nervous energy going, but I think I'll settle in here in just a few moments.
Didn't you have like a big presentation of sorts?
I did. I did a TEDx talk in Virginia, Minnesota with the TEDx presentation. The whole night was about crossing the divide. So the theme was called Crossing the Divide. And I talked about how amplifying Native voices helped me find my own voice. So that can be found online. I'm not sure where, but I think it's out there now. So you might have to do a little digging to find that.
A little investigative work. No, I'm very proud of you, Leah. Good job. Good job.
Thank you. It was, 15, 16 minutes or so. All memorized.
Did it just fly by, or was it like?
It just flew by. I didn't fall off the stage. I think I hit all my points, and I didn't go way over time. Mm-hmm. So, all in all,
they didn't play like the get off the stage music, like they do at the Oscars.
No, they didn't. They didn't bust out the shepherd's crook. Just
no, that's good.
They did hold up. Here's how many minutes you have left, like a 5 minute and a 1 minute. Nice. Yeah. Nice. Oh, it's kind of funny.
Well, awesome.
It's like, I don't know what to do about that, but fine. I'll wrap
Great.
It up.
Well, check it out, listeners. Look it up.
Thank you for asking.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited for this week and our guest. We are speaking with Ruth Buffalo, a citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation. Ruth is an educator, community organizer, and public health professional. She is a former Fargo Native American commissioner and former member of the North Dakota House of Representatives. And among many of her accomplishments as a lawmaker, Ruth introduced new laws that focused on public safety, prevention, and awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people, and as well as human trafficking. And over the years, she's been recognized and honored multiple times for her work. And now here's where the Minnesota angle comes into play. In late February 2024, which was last month as of this recording, Ruth Buffalo was announced as the new CEO of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center, which is a nonprofit social and mental health services organization based in Minneapolis. So can't wait to talk to her on all of that, including what brought her to this point, digging into how she wants to drive the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center's work forward, and a lot more. And here she is. Bonjour, Ruth.
Hi.
Hello.
All right. Could you please start out by introducing yourself and telling us all that good stuff?
Sure. Dosha, Madashi, Mia Adesh heads, Mabe, Sigids, Madzigadads, Nakbaga'o. I'm Ruth Buffalo, and I am an enrolled citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Rikra Nation. And I'm also a descendant of Chiricahua Apache. I am originally from Mandaree, North Dakota, which is located at what is present-day Fort Berthold Indian Reservation on the western side of North Dakota.
Great. How are you doing? How's the family doing?
Doing pretty good. Thanks.
And where are you joining us from?
I'm dialing in from the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center.
Gotcha. Over there in South Minneapolis.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, it's nice to finally be able to talk to you. I've admired your work from afar, and this is really exciting. So, Ruth, is there something that's going on these days that's kind of at the top of your mind?
Within MIWRC, we are currently fundraising, really trying to rebuild the programs and the services that are provided here. So I just started March 4th. So this is my third Monday on the job and just really excited to be here. But something that's top of mind is our traditional birthing program has a lot of exciting upcoming activities and programming. They're having Esther Humphrey come in, and she's going to be talking about moss bags and sharing her birthing story. And that's a two-day event that will be held here at MIWRC, April 16th and 17th.
I didn't realize it was so soon since
you've
been on. How about you give us a bit of an overview of the Resource Center?
Sure. The Resource Center has downsized quite a bit since the pandemic, and we're looking to do more outreach within the community, but also look at what community needs are not being met right now and how can we work together with existing programs and strengthen partnerships throughout the community here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area. I have such great respect for the founders of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center and all of the good work that has happened over the decades. It's a huge responsibility to make sure that we are serving the community here to the best of our ability. So really looking to learn more, you know, myself, learn more about the existing programs that we have here within MIWRC, but we're also looking to expand and continue partnering with other organizations and entities within the Twin Cities metro area.
Great. And as you mentioned, you just started out as the CEO. And, you know, what inspired your move to this position? You know, you've done a lot of great work in North Dakota, and we'll certainly talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a really good question. What really prompted me to, I guess, take action and dive into this role is the need for direct services within our communities. It's another piece to the puzzle of solving the MMIP crisis, missing and murdered Indigenous people. I was an appointed member of the Not Invisible Act Commission, and we hosted a number of field hearings across and throughout the United States, or what is present day, you know, the United States. And from sitting on those panels, listening to the communities, listening to those who are closest to the pain, really left a huge mark on my heart, on my overall of who I am as a person and what my sense of purpose is on this earth. And it really put a lot of things into perspective. You know, I've spent some time doing policy work and prevention of further tragedies from happening, but I also believe that we can help make a difference in the services that we provide to our relatives who are most impacted by violence on a daily basis.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're speaking with Ruth Buffalo, a citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara Nation, who has been doing community advocacy work for over 25 years. A former North Dakota lawmaker, Ruth now leads the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis.
Is there a philosophy that you bring to the RC?
The notion or idea of rebuilding, building from the ground up. I feel that I have some expertise in that area. I think we all do in terms of being
indigenous peoples, or, you know, the first peoples of these lands that are also known as, you know, present day United States. I think it's our inherent right to continue to take action, to accept responsibility in helping our relatives live a good, healthy, long life, if possible.
Is there something, maybe an example growing up that kind of led to that sense of purpose?
I think growing up in a matriarchal, matrilineal household, a community, a tribal nation, it sort of naturally is a part of who we are as Hidatsa people. I was raised amongst my mom's people, and so it's primarily or predominantly a Hidatsa community of Mandaree, even though the name Mandaree includes all three of the tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, or the three affiliated tribes. But I remember growing up in Mandaree and always being with my mom, or my mom would always have me with the women elders. I would be visiting them, or vice versa, or always being outside. We grew up in Mandaree, but west of Mandaree, if you're familiar with like the Pick Sloan Act and the impact it had on communities up and down the Missouri River, early 1950s, 94% of our agricultural land was flooded, and being historically traditional, you know, farmers and gardeners, it had a direct impact on our life expectancy and years of life lost. And I truly believe that is why my grandparents passed away at a young age. Growing up, we used to always go out to my grandparents' house, which is located in this area called Independence. And that's the new area where people relocated or were forcibly removed from the bottomlands, known as Elba Woods, which always sounds like Pleasantville when the elders and everyone would speak of their time being in the bottomlands, where it was very fertile land. You know, we had a lot of crops. We were very self-sufficient, had our own school system and our hospital, you know, but then when the Pick Sloan Act came about, you know, 94% of our agricultural land was flooded, and we were then forcibly removed once more, but to rough, barren grazeland, and many families relocated to larger cities like Minneapolis, San Francisco, Cleveland, Ohio, but my grandparents chose to stay. So I think of my grandparents and the struggles they endured really is a part of who we are today. But gardening and giving and sharing is also a big part of our values. Growing up in a rural tribal community, we had this large garden and we always had a surplus of produce. But even though that's not what we referred to it as, we just had like a lot of extra tomatoes, potatoes, corn, squash, cucumbers, and we would always just share that with the community. But first and foremost, the elders, and we would go door to door. My mom had this old steel, big, long car. I can't remember the model and make of it, but it was just a steel, old car, and it had a deep trunk. And so back then, you know, brown paper bags were in abundance, and so you would always have all the potatoes and cucumbers, everything, you know, kind of separated out in those big brown bags. And we would just go door to door. And my older brother, who is closest to me in age, a year older than me, him and I would just kind of squeeze in the back trunk. And my mom would slowly go driving around Mandaree door to door. And I think that was like my first experience of going door knocking. I was pretty young, but it was fun. And I felt it really brought our community together. And so, yeah, that's kind of something, long answer to your question.
No, that's great. What a fun, but, you know, helpful thing to do as a young kid, to just bring some extra food around. That's amazing. So the years go by, and then you want to get into changing public policy and becoming a lawmaker. When did becoming a lawmaker become something that you wanted to do?
Back in, I think, 2011, I was asked to run for Mandaree West Segment Tribal Council Rep, but I had prior commitments that I was already pretty heavily involved with. And then later, I was asked again to run for, it's a state office, state insurance commissioner, when I was in grad school at NDSU finishing a Master of Public Health. And that was in 2016 when I ran. It's my first time running, but I was just really looking to try to get more involved in local politics and really wanting to see how I could help get the Native vote out. And then next thing I knew, I was running in a statewide race for insurance commissioner. But I would say what sort of piqued my interest was in our class lectures for Master of Public Health. We were in the specialization for American Indian Public Health. And one day our instructor said, poor health is a result of poor policy. And that really resonated with me. And then when you took a dive deeper into, you know, who is behind these policies, who's implementing these policies, and then when you learn further of who exactly is responsible for the policies or the laws that are being passed, we found that it wasn't very reflective of the communities that different lawmakers were representing. So it just made sense to take the plunge to dive into running for public office so that we could have our perspectives at the table and be a voice, you know, for the communities who are often ignored. But we used to always joke after class with our lectures in the public health program at North Dakota State University in Fargo. We used to say, well, one of us is just going to have to take the plunge and do it, you know, but we would just start laughing. And while our instructor was like packing up their things and, you know, trying to exit the classroom, I think as quickly as they could, sort of like they would have no part in that conversation type of a thing, you know. So then I guess when the opportunity came about, you know, I was asked to run and I just decided to because one of my classmates in grad school, we were organizing a peaceful demonstration across from the venue where an entertainer was coming to the Fargo Theater back then, and he had a very unkind platform that targeted Native Americans. And so we tried to get the event canceled, or, you know, we just didn't want it coming to Fargo, and we didn't want that hatred or rhetoric and language to be trickled back into our children's classrooms, because a lot of our kids, you know, were in the Fargo Public School District. And so we just wanted to find an avenue to make change and to address this, because it was really horrible things that were being said. In that day and age, we thought it was just like April Fool's prank when we heard the promotional things on the internet, but because it was right around April Fool's Day when we found out about this and learned about this event coming to the Fargo-Moorhead area. And then the venue wasn't willing to cancel, neither was the entity that was bringing the entertainer to town. But eventually, this entertainer did cancel his show and then was supposed to reschedule, but that never happened. But from those efforts of trying to, you know, just organize a peaceful demonstration across the street from the venue of that particular entertainer, my colleague, my classmate, and I, both moms, we just were trying to find ways to make change, you know, to like, because I remember thinking that, like, what's it going to take for North Dakota to change? Because I went through the same things as a young kid, as a youth. And then now my kids were the same age, and now they're having to be exposed to hatred towards Native Americans or American Indians or Indigenous people or Hidatsa people, you know. So when I was asked to run for office, I was kind of already fired up by then. So I was like, yeah, I think I will run for office, because I saw it as a way to, you know, spread counter hate on a larger scale across the state of North Dakota at that time.
Wow. So that being fired up really like opened up that avenue for you to do it, because I imagine it's not easy to run for office.
Yeah, I think it is scary at first. And I remember when I was signing the candidacy papers in 2016 to run for insurance commissioner, I remember asking the then executive director of the party, you know, the Democratic Nonpartisan League in North Dakota, I remember asking him, there's not going to be any debates, is there? And he was like, no. But I always share that story because then there was a debate on Prairie Public Television, and it was funny. On my personal Facebook account, I put, run for office. They said, you know, there will be no debates, they said. And then I shared a clip of, like, it looked like a 1980s film because of just the color, everything, and then the music in the background. And then the host is like, welcome to our insurance commissioner debate, you know, and we're all sitting in the background smiling. But yeah, I survived, you know, the debate. It wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. So, but yeah, I would say it is, it just depends on the person. I mean, I wasn't ever involved in like speech or debate team in high school. I always thought that was for like really outgoing kids and stuff. But I would encourage people, you know, I think it is good to have a good skill to have, you know, that public speaking tool.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Ruth Buffalo, a citizen of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation who has been doing community advocacy work for over 25 years. A former North Dakota lawmaker, Ruth now leads the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis. So I'm sorry, what is an insurance commissioner?
It oversees all of the insurance policies, doings within the state of North Dakota, big to corporate to small, like insurance agents and credentials and addressing fraudulent behavior, the Affordable Care Act, you know, everything, any and all things that have to do with insurance. The insurance commissioner is supposed to be like the watchdog and supposed to be looking out for the public's best interest.
The insurance commissioner, how did that position springboard you into being a representative? And, you know, before you assigned your papers for that, did you ask them if there was going to be a debate?
So, yeah, the insurance commissioner run or the campaign was a little bit different than the legislative district race for 27, because the statewide race, we were trying to hit as many community events statewide as we could. So we would constantly zigzag the state of North Dakota and trying to reach as many people as we could. And we also did like a mini tour with Chase and Marlo. And we had at the time Mark Trahant, who was at the University of North Dakota, but I believe he oversees Indian Country Today, but he's a very well-known journalist. I think he's originally from Montana, but he followed us around for a little mini statewide tour campaign. And simply because the media really wasn't giving us any coverage. So a lot of times during our campaign, I felt like it was what I saw on TV and what I read about during like the early 1950s, 60s, and 70s, where there was some serious polarization within our country. And the Dakota Access Pipeline, resistant camps, and the everything with the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, that basically hit the fan at that time was right smack dab during our run for statewide office. So towards the end of our campaigns, when we go into different small rural communities, people didn't really, they kind of really didn't care about our platform. Their first question was, have you been to the camps? Have you been, you know, to the protests? You know, and these were questions coming from non-natives. So those were interesting times. But so a statewide race definitely prepared me for legislative district race, in that it was a smaller concentrated area. So knocking doors, like knocking 5,000, 6,000 doors in a smaller concentrated condensed area, didn't seem as daunting as trying to reach so many communities and towns across the state of North Dakota.
Great. And can you talk about some of the things that you accomplished as a lawmaker?
So my first session in 2019, we were able to get 7 out of the 8 bills introduced passed in both the Senate and the House. Majority of them focused on public safety, which included a missing persons database, law enforcement regarding missing and murdered Indigenous people, human trafficking prevention and awareness for schools and hotels, a resolution urging Congress to pass Savannah's Act, and a comprehensive study looking at the intersection between human trafficking and MMIP cases, and an eagle feather, eagle plume bill that would prohibit school boards from stopping Native graduates from wearing an eagle feather, eagle plume during their high school graduation, which is sad to even have to introduce that or, you know, into a new law. And that was in 2019. And we had a few schools and a few legislators at the time that were sort of in denial that such a bill was needed, but in particular Mandan. And we had students come up to me after the legislative session at their graduation celebrations and share how closely they were watching that particular bill, because their school was not going to allow them to wear eagle feather or eagle plume on their graduation cap for their graduation, which is just crazy. My second term was like completely night and day. Geez, I had a bunch of diverse bills my second term, but it was right in the middle of the pandemic in North Dakota, where vaccines and masks were on the chopping block within our state legislature. And so one of the bills I introduced was putting a cap on late rent fees, getting dark money out of elections. I think if you Google, though, North Dakota legislature, you'll find my little biography and all of the bills that I introduced or co-signed on. I am the original bill author of the Native American History Bill, SB 2304, which requires Native history to be taught in all schools, public and non, in grades K through 12.
Great, thank you. So we're running low on time, but we always like to ask, just any final thoughts as we wrap up?
I think, you know, we want the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center to be a place where people can go to get help and not be turned away. I think that that's something that is needed and that we need to continue to remind ourselves in doing community advocacy work, is how can we help each other to the best of our ability and not, you know, cause further harm to ourselves, to each other, to the families and the community. So how can we become a place that people can come to get help, to where MIWRC is thriving and flourishing in the future? I remember Linda Eagle Speaker shared beautiful stories, you know, at the community meet and greet that they hosted my first week. And she shared, you know, like she could still hear and see children laughing and playing. And to me, that's the most beautiful thing, is to hear children laughing and playing, because it tells me that it's a safe, healthy, you know, environment.
That was great. I like that bit at the end, you know, just it can be as simple as just asking each other how you can be of help.
Absolutely. And if you're interested, you can learn more about the MIWRC on their website, miwrc.org. But we have both their website and their GoFundMe site on our episode page at minnesotanativenews.org.
Miigwech to Ruth Buffalo, a citizen of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation, who now leads the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.